In the coming week, crisis diplomacy ratchets up amid rising tensions with Russia. It's the 50th anniversary of President Nixon's historic trip to China, and the UN Environment Program issues its annual Frontiers Report. It's February 17th, 2022, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's begin our conversation this week by talking about the Munich Security Conference. It is set to begin over the weekend. This yearly conference on foreign affairs and international security policy has been held since 1963. This year's delegation is being headed by Vice President Kamala Harris. It's obviously coming amidst the Ukraine crisis. Can you tell us a bit about what's going to be happening in Munich, Bob?
Sure, Jim. It's a very timely security conference. Typically, it does deal with matters of European security, and Russia and NATO usually have been the centerpiece in previous years. And this year, I should start off by talking about kind of the diplomatic drama playing out as a backdrop. As we're taping this podcast, the UN Security Council was convening a meeting on Ukraine. We should note Russia is the rotating president of the Security Council, and it's teed up a meeting on Ukraine. It has already reportedly filed a report with the UN accusing Ukrainian authorities and military of crimes committed in its separatist regions where there has been an ongoing war since 2014. Ukraine denies that and has counter-reported that Russia has actually been attacking Ukrainian positions in and around Donetsk. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will be at the Security Council meeting where he will lay out a case that Russia is drumming up provocations and what the U.S. calls false flag operations to justify an invasion. And President Biden this morning had said that invasion is probably days away. So it very much seems like something is about to happen there. There has been cyber attacks on Ukrainian sites this week. There have been ongoing moves in the Black Sea with Russian vessels seemingly moving to blockade Ukraine. And Russia just this morning expelled the number two U.S. diplomat in Moscow in a sign of another escalation. So as the Munich Security Conference gets going with all sorts of discussions of security, Ukraine is a centerpiece. Kamala Harris can be expected to be sort of articulating and reiterating U.S. policy and potential response if something does play out in the course of this security conference, Jim.
Just to review what we know about what's happening in Ukraine, Bob. Earlier this week, the Russians indicated they were drawing down troops near the borders of Ukraine. Has that in fact happened?
By many accounts, and again, you have to keep an eye on, and this is going to be important throughout this crisis, you have to keep an eye on many different sources of information and credible sources. Media in the West is relying on U.S. officials, but also other independent accounts, satellite footage and so forth. And collectively, they are not showing a major drawdown. In fact, as the U.S. says, something like 7,000 additional Russian troops have been added to deployments closer to Ukraine. So it does seem like a buildup is imminent. And not only that, the troops are leaving bases in preparation for some sort of action. Again, we'll wait to see how this plays out, but this is the latest that we know.
And certainly the U.S. government has acted on the presumption that an attack is imminent. They've told Americans to leave Ukraine. They have drawn down the size of the U.S. embassy and staff in Kyiv. Do we have any greater sense as to what this invasion might look like? Because as we talked before in the podcast, it could be something that is a modest, in quotation marks, incursion into Ukraine. It could be all the way up to a full-scale invasion. Any clarity on any of this?
Jim, I would go with some of the latest insights from people who closely follow Russian actions and its quote-unquote near abroad, some of which have pointed to Russian actions in 2008 against Georgia and almost identical language and positioning going on before there was a Russian incursion into Georgia. That happened after some Georgian forces fired on positions in South Ossetia, which is a separatist region of Georgia. And you had Russian troops rolling in and really relatively unmatched before they stopped and pulled back. But now, you know, de facto, South Ossetia and the separatist region of Abkhazia are under Russia's sway. So the sentiment is that we could see a further strengthening expansion of separatist slash Russian positions in Luhansk and Donetsk. And you just had the Russian parliament earlier this week also taking a vote on observing their independence, I think was the wording of it. But basically taking steps to and gestures that would sort of de facto on the Russian side, you know, observe these regions as separatists. Also, by the way, totally quashing the Minsk process, which is supposed to be all about these regions remaining part of Ukraine, but having more independence, Jim. So it seems to be focused on those two regions, as opposed to perhaps a full-scale invasion that would include shelling Kyiv and seizing Odessa and so forth. But certainly the size of the Russian buildup has given way to all sorts of scenarios.
What do we know about the position of the Ukrainian government? Has President Zelensky taken any steps to try to reconcile with Moscow to find some common ground?
Not according to the latest reports I've seen, Jim. Certainly there is concern, and there is concern about what could be coming for Ukraine. But we had not too long ago an attempt to revisit the Minsk talks in which Ukraine was starting to feel some more pressure to cede to the Russian position that would give a great deal of autonomy to separatist representatives and separatist forces in these regions, which is very unpopular and domestically in Ukraine. Ukraine did not yield on that. Ukraine has not yielded on its position that it wants to belong to NATO. And so unless there is some turnabout that is looming, it doesn't seem like it. The other thing, though, that's interesting is Ukraine is seemingly being extremely reserved in its response to the ratcheting up of shelling in the eastern region in terms of not wanting to be accused of taking provocative, aggressive steps that could justify some sort of Russian action.
Bob, as I've been tracking a lot of the news stories about the potential Russian invasion, I've heard two points being made. One, the Russians wouldn't invade until the Olympics concluded as a conciliatory gesture to Beijing, but also that the Russians couldn't wait too long because as the weather warms up, the terrain will be less friendly for moving mass numbers of troops. Do you have some sense of sort of what the period of maximum danger is? I believe the Olympics end this week, but when would it become too difficult for the Russians to conduct a large-scale intervention/invasion?
Well, to the points you made, Jim, I think, which are valid ones, and the Olympics wrap up on Sunday, there are Russian sizable exercises going on in neighboring Belarus. Those are supposed to end this weekend as well, and it could be an opportunity for de-escalation, which is what some hope coming into the week, but it also could be, this is yet another scenario, the Belarusian border is very close to some major Ukrainian cities, and maybe that's a jumping off point for another incursion or some sort of sign of force, Jim. So potentially it dovetails with what's supposed to be the wrapping up of exercises with Belarusian forces. Potentially it dovetails with the wrapping up of the Olympics. Again, the messaging coming out, the signs coming out from the region, the messaging coming out from U.S. officials, the gestures that we're going to start seeing at the UN all seem to be laying the groundwork, Jim, for something happening very soon.
Now, President Biden has said explicitly, Bob, that the United States is not going to send troops to defend Ukraine. But is there a potential for a clash between Russian forces and NATO forces?
I think that's the big concern, because there are NATO forces that are in Poland and the Baltics, and there are air patrols, and there are some naval patrols. We've been hearing reports about very close encounters involved in airspace and in involving some submarine activity and so forth. Again, those reports also need to be parsed very carefully because of where they're coming from. Some are coming from the Russian side, some are coming from NATO side. But there is a great deal of concern that there could be an unintended mishap there. I think that's one of the reasons why you tend to see fairly regular reports of communications between defense officials from the U.S. and Russia in particular. I would imagine NATO capitals also have their lines of communication open, Jim. So it's not out of the realm of possibility. They do want to support. They've certainly rhetorically and with some material, NATO nations have supported Ukraine, but Ukrainians are still, I think, understanding that they are largely on their own here.
Well, I should point out there's always the potential in crises like this for the unintended or unanticipated to really change the direction of any conflict. I'll note that last couple of days, Russian planes came very close to U.S. planes over the Mediterranean, I believe. I think one news report I saw said came within 5 feet. Obviously, if that sort of close contact leads to a crash, that could change the context significantly and really up the ante for both sides. And it's always the question of how do people interpret those, let's call them curveballs or surprises that happen in the midst of a crisis, could take you in a direction nobody anticipated. I'm also wondering, Bob, have people given thought to what would happen on the ground? Should an invasion take place? Are we likely to see large waves of refugees fleeing Ukraine, going into the border countries, creating pressure on them as well?
That's certainly an area that's been anticipated, and there's increasing focus there, Jim, because there is a concern. And again, depending on the scale of what happens militarily. valley. We have seen a great deal of displacement, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians displaced from those eastern regions. And depending on how much Russia pushes in and how long Russia stays, if that indeed happens, certainly we would see movement internally in Ukraine. And that requires all sorts of help. And even though it's, you know, the UN Refugee Agency officially, you know, steps in, for example, when there's, you know, people cross borders and have needs, there's a lot of aid that can be provided through NGOs and others for those displaced. So that is a very real possibility, Jim. And many of the reports, there's a good number of journalists that are still in the country. Many of the reports are showing Ukrainians are have a grim, fatal realism about going about their business. Some have noted also Ukraine's also been technically at war for 8 years now. So it's a question of, you know, sort of what they're prepared to do. But certainly other outside countries are trying to take steps to make sure their nationals are out, the U.S. in particular, trying to make sure it's nimble and able to get thousands of people out of the country. And so there's going to be a lot of things set in motion, Jim. We should also mention the economic impact. Markets are getting very antsy right now. There's been a lot of upheaval in global markets.
Oil prices will go up.
Oil prices have gone up and are likely to continue to go up. We're looking at $120 a barrel, according to some projections. That's happening at the pump in the U.S. It's going to happen in Europe. Those kind of talks are also going to continue, I think, at what we mentioned, the Munich Security Conference also deals with things like energy security as well.
Well, it's an interesting point, Bob, because if oil prices go up, Russia obviously benefits being a major producer of oil. It also has the potential to cut off or jack up prices of the gas it sends to Europe. And to show how all these things are interconnected, the Biden administration is trying to persuade the Saudis to pump more oil to bring the price of oil down. But the Saudis essentially have a deal with the Russians on oil prices that so far MBS has been unwilling to break. And again, let's keep in mind that Joe Biden came into office saying that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia was essentially a persona non grata. And now, again, people do have memories. I also do wonder, Bob, just getting back to the issue of refugees, we have seen Belarus in the last year weaponize refugees trying to put pressure on the Baltic countries. You know, if we do get an invasion, it's an entirely new chapter. It's an entirely new book. It isn't necessarily the case that the crisis ends there. This could metastasize. There are a number of things the Russians could do in response to the likely penalties to come from the West, from NATO countries, EU countries, to basically push back. So I wouldn't assume that it's simply a matter of Russians invade, the West imposes sanctions, and we have a new normal. It could go further than that.
Yeah, very good point. And the weaponization of refugees, unfortunately, is something we might very well see, because it is a vulnerable point for certainly in Western European countries, as we have seen repeatedly, and as we saw over the incident with Belarus, Jim.
Yeah, this is the potential to be a game changer, if I can use that phrase.
Well, Jim, I want to take us back to a period when diplomacy, startling diplomacy, actually turned the tide in what had been a kind of a grim front, and that was the U.S.-China relations. This coming Monday, February 21st, marks 50 years since President Richard Nixon, a Cold War era hawk, made a trip to Beijing. The Nixon in China became kind of a metaphor for, you know, unusual things could happen if there was boldness involved in diplomacy. Nixon met with the chairman, Mao Zedong. It ended decades of isolation between the two countries and ultimately led to the establishment of diplomatic relations in 1979. Jim, can you give us a sense about the significance of this trip as we look at this anniversary?
We'd love to, Bob. You know, Richard Nixon called it the week that changed the world, and he was right. For anyone who didn't live through it, it's hard to grasp just how significant it was. We now live in a time in which we get our iPads, our iPhones, and seemingly everything else from China, and we can turn our TVs on this week and watch Olympic bobsledding and figure skating coming to us from venues in and around Beijing. But in 1972, China was a far-off, mysterious place that was off-limits to Americans. Just 7 years earlier, the Lyndon Johnson administration had actively considered bombing China to stop its nuclear weapons program. Relations continued to be so frosty that the visit of an American table tennis team to China in April 1971 was front page news around the world. And what made the visit all the more remarkable is what you pointed out, that it was Nixon being the president to go to China. He had cut his political teeth as a staunch anti-communist. He had repeatedly blasted Democrats for being soft on communists. And here he was going to China to meet Mao. Now, Nixon's trip, which the great historian Margaret Millen has done an excellent job recreating in her book, Nixon and Mao, was on the face of it, an admission of what everyone already knew, that communist China was here to stay. The United States had not recognized the communist Chinese government after it came to power in October of 1949. But Nixon had two other objectives in mind. One was grand, one was narrow. The grand objective was to drive a wedge between China and the Soviet Union. The narrow objective was to persuade the Chinese to put pressure on North Vietnam. Remember, at this time, the United States was still engaged in the Vietnam War. He didn't make much progress in persuading the Chinese to bring the North Vietnamese to the table, but he certainly made progress on his effort to try to drive this wedge between Moscow and Beijing. Now, as you point out, Nixon did not establish formal relations with China. That would come with Jimmy Carter in 1979. But I think we can look at Nixon's trip as the opening to the era of strategic engagement, and it produced one of the foundational agreements in the Shanghai communique, the idea of a one-China policy. We're now 50 years on, and it's pretty clear that the era of strategic engagement is dead. We're now in an era of strategic competition. And in a way, things have been flipped on their head. You know, it is now Russia and China that are working together. President Xi and Putin made that clear with the missive they issued on the eve of the Olympics lambasting the United States. We may even be seeing the emergence of an axis of the aggrieved as Beijing and Moscow work with countries like Iran, Venezuela, and others that have beefs with the United States to put pressure on the so-called liberal rules-based order. And I think the big test for U.S. foreign policy in the next half century is going to be to find ways to break up and frustrate that collaboration.
No, it is fascinating to reflect on that, Jim. And just to seize on one of those points, the China-Russia relations that have evolved does also recall the fact that Nixon had a number of things going on at the same time. He was also working on detente with the Soviet Union, and in so doing, raising questions in Moscow about, you know, what the U.S. intentions were in China, and this sort of balancing that was going on was seen as kind of a masterstroke in foreign policy, because detente did end up easing up the circumstances between the United States and Russia in a number of ways, in addition to a visit to China opening up that relationship. And I think most people could agree the world was better off for that opening up, even while there were things happening domestically in both countries that were very much distasteful. But we're in this era now, though, where you have authoritarianism. You still have communism in China of a different bent. You have authoritarianism in Russia, and they are exporting that authoritarianism in a way that is really challenging the U.S., and it doesn't seem to have the bigger diplomatic chops to try to parry it. It's just kind of responding as opposed to sort of, you know, orchestrating things.
Certainly is, Bob. And I think if you look back over the last dozen or so years of U.S. foreign policy, there have been efforts to try to, I'll borrow the word, reset relations, particularly with Russia, and it just hasn't worked. And we just spent, you know, a few minutes talking about the current big issue in U.S.-Russian relations, namely Ukraine. So the prospects for finding a way to put U.S.-Russian relations on a better footing and to try to drive a wedge between Russia and China, it's hard to get optimistic about that at this moment.
So as you mentioned, the formal relations emerged in 79. That was quickly followed by the Taiwan Relations Act, which has continued to resonate now as Xi Jinping is growing more and more assertive, and especially toward Taiwan. Is that a legacy that we're going to sort of revisit as well, or is that intertwined with the U.S.-Russia sort of tensions at this point as well, Jim?
Well, all of these things are intertwined, Bob, and I think there's a lot of speculation. I think it really should be called speculation right now on how Chinese leaders are reading the reaction of the United States and the West to what the Russians are seeking to do. And I think this is going to continue to be a lot of debate with people trying to read the tea leaves to draw or to try to determine what lessons should be drawn from the Ukraine crisis, whether it is going to make the Chinese leadership more hesitant to bring pressure on Taiwan or more eager to put pressure on Taiwan. So, you know, we live in very difficult times, and they're likely to grow more difficult or turbulent going forward, precisely because you have great power competition and there's no agreed upon set of rules of the road, to borrow that phrase, that govern those relations. And it is quite clear that both Moscow and Beijing want to fundamentally revise the global order that has prevailed for the last 75 years. And the United States, which has led that order, is not inclined to do so. And so something is going to have to give. Now, you're hoping that we can have diplomacy that can find a way to square the circle among those competing interests. But history, if it's any guide, suggests that sometimes diplomacy can fail. The great risk, obviously, is that we live in a world of weapons of considerable destruction. Even if nuclear weapons aren't used, the capacity of modern weapons to wreak havoc are well known and well documented. And so again, these are very difficult times. And the hope is that diplomacy can find a way out of the cul-de-sac we find ourselves in currently.
At the very least, one would hope there could be some inspiration coming from, again, what happened 50 years ago to create some new out-of-the-box thinking about these really tough relations.
We shall see.
Well, Jim, let's go from the geopolitical landscape to the broader global landscape of the environment. I want to talk about the UN Environment Program's latest annual Frontiers Report. Each of these annual issues highlight environmental challenges as well as possible solutions. Could you tell us a bit more about the report this year, Jim?
Well, Bob, this year's report dropped just this morning, so you can go online at the UN Environmental Program and download it. And the report, which only got to glance at briefly, highlights three topics: noise pollution in cities, the threat of wildfires, and phenological changes, that is, changes in the timing of the annual cycles of plants and animals. It turns out that when trees leaf out, where fish swim, and when eggs hatch is extremely sensitive to changes in climate. And the report sort of focuses both on small-scale and large-scale solutions to all three of those challenges. And I'll just note them quickly. In terms of noise pollution, we are witnessing historic levels of urbanization. Vast majority of people live in cities, but cities are very loud. And it turns out that prolonged exposure to high levels of noise leads to shorter lifespans, less healthier people. And the report talks about a variety of ways that you can lower noise pollution in cities. Tree belt, green roofs, these are things that will absorb sound. You can have bike lanes, which take cars and other vehicles off the road. And we even see in Paris these days, they're about to install noise traps, sort of like speed traps, that are designed to detect vehicles that are simply too loud. You know, in terms of wildfires, they're a growing problem around the world. We've seen terrible fires in Australia, in California. There was a study published just this week that concluded that the drought in the American Southwest that began in 2000 is the worst since at least 800. So we have the prospect of continued wildfires in the American West and Southwest. And I think part of the challenge there is, how can you mobilize quickly to stop fires early on? What are best practices, things like that? And finally, the big question of addressing phenological change, that's really an issue that gets back to the broader issue of climate change. And I think we as humans probably underestimate how interconnected biological systems are and the consequences for what happens, or the consequences when those interconnections are disrupted and broken. I mean, obviously, we are facing a world in which things that grew or prospered in one place may no longer do so, but we as humans are used to having them around. Think of the importance of having fisheries, or even something simple as where you can grow maple syrup. It's a big industry in New Hampshire, but because of climate change, sugar maples basically are migrating north into Canada. And when you sort of start thinking about how to deal with climate change, you have a series of both high-tech and low-tech solutions. And on the low-tech side, you have things like reforestation, but you're probably going to need a lot of high technology to play a role, both to reduce emissions as well as to capture them. And there are a lot of interesting things happening on the technology front, whether we're talking about efforts to build all-electric planes. That's what NASA is up to, because, you know, planes account for about 2% of global carbon emissions. You know, can we have technology that allows us to make cleaner cement? Cement's another big source of putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. There's efforts to create so-called green cement that can be produced at lower temperatures, which leads to less carbon dioxide. The marine shipping industry is looking toward whether ships can be powered by hydrogen fuel cells. Turns out that naval shipping accounts for 2 to 3% of global carbon emissions. You know, we have South Korea, you know, installing a large floating solar array on a water reservoir to try to generate electricity. And there's even an effort in Nova Scotia to build a floating platform that tries to use the tides to turn power turbines to generate electricity. And you also have older technologies. I'll note that this week, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that France is going to build 6 nuclear reactors by 2050, with an option to build up to 14. The argument being that with nuclear power, you can generate energy without contributing heat-trapping gases, though obviously nuclear energy has a whole set of other challenges that come with it. And of course, the holy grail is whether you can develop technology that can actually take carbon out of the atmosphere. And while there are a lot of promising signs to look at, I think the big question is, are these technologies going to come online fast enough to save us from catastrophic climate change? And I think the fear is that they won't. And on that score, a piece of sobering news that came out this week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that's a U.S. government agency, predicted that sea levels along the U.S. coast will rise by a foot on average by 2050. That's just 28 years from now. And NOAA said that that rise is likely to occur regardless of how green gas emissions are mitigated in the future. Very sobering warning.
Yeah, Jim, it seems like you just have to kind of brace yourself every time a new environmental report comes out. Although it is interesting to hear as you went through those priorities and those issues that there are solutions. There are any number of solutions. It's really the speed in which the world can deal with them. Countries individually have shown they're willing to kind of embrace them. And I would note just on the electric vehicle front, you know, I think in some ways it addresses the two areas chiefly, which is the carbon emissions and the noise pollution factor. You know, the thrum of a you know, electric car, as we've all noticed, is pretty silent. It's actually almost dangerously silent. And that could also be the case for airplanes. I wish they would also extend to leaf blowers, given the noisiness my suburban neighborhood experienced this past fall. But the other thing I would note for that is there's always trade-offs. And you mentioned nuclear power. The trade-off there is the nuclear waste issue. You know, with electric vehicles, it's the battery issue. They rely heavily on lithium. Lithium is the product of sometimes very messy mining. And so countries just need to be able to deal with these trade-offs. Again, they'll do it individually, but I'm not sure if there's anything close to the collective action needed to have this happen globally and make the changes you're talking about, Jim.
And that's the root problem that we face, Bob. Well, Bob, I think it is time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week. Listeners can vote on our audience figure of the week or tweet us one at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience voted for 8 million Yemenis to lose aid. Fill us in on why this is the audience figure of the week.
Well, Jim, we've talked about Yemen previously on this podcast and mostly in terms of the humanitarian crisis. In the past few years, it's been either the worst or one of the worst in the world, and it has not really changed. What has changed recently has been that the war has ramped up there, that you have increasing fighting, airstrikes, shelling, and small arms fire, et cetera, going on in the battle between pro-government forces and people known as the Houthi rebels. And these 8 million are people who represent about a quarter of Yemen's population. Many more people in Yemen than that even are dependent on aid for basic foodstuffs and other materials needed to survive. And the cuts that are being envisioned right now, something like two-thirds of major UN aid programs are being scaled back or closed because there are, as we've discussed in this podcast, there are so many competing areas of need. Afghanistan dealing with an epic crisis as well in the aftermath of the Taliban takeover. You have Eastern Africa's wars going on in Ethiopia. You have problems with both fighting and drought in places like Sudan and Somalia and so forth. Western Africa has its share of woes as well. And so not to mention Myanmar, which is sort of a series of battles going on across that country 1 year into their coup. So it's sort of like, where do you begin? Where do you cut? Or can you increase? From what I've seen, there are some renewed efforts by some nations. I think Sweden and Switzerland are going to try to rally for some sort of a global aid effort to help Yemen. Because if we do hit this and 8 million Yemenis are bereft of aid, then we're looking at something that even the world has not seen recently, which is a truly appalling level of humanitarian need and privation.
And Bob, it could be happening at at a time in which much of the developed world will have its focus not on the Middle East, not on Yemen, but on Ukraine and the potential spillover effects from a Russian intervention if one should happen.
Right, which again brings us back to the start of our discussion today, Jim. It is a world in disarray and the options are not looking great.
No, they're not.
And that's our look at the troubled world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The Beijing Winter Olympics will be wrapping up this weekend. The World Trade Organization General Council meets in Geneva. And Ukraine marks the anniversary of the Maidan Square massacre.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be careful out there.